He didn't ask for permission. He sang with fire, walked with discipline, and rewrote the blueprint for what it meant to be a revolutionary voice in modern reggae. From August Town to global stages, from Black Woman and Child to Judgment Yard, Sizzla Kalonji didn't just make music. He made a mission. This is not just a story about albums, it's about identity, about culture, about how one man used sound to resist erasure and ignite generations. Caribbean history, Sizzla, The Fire Still Burns. A cinematic audiobook journey into the legacy, controversy, and cultural power of one of reggae's most enduring warriors. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Before the flames, before the chants, before the thunder of bass lines and the blaze of righteous fury, there was a boy in August Town. Miguel Orlando Collins was born on April 17, 1976, in the heart of this hilly Kingston district, a place teetering between spiritual richness and political volatility. To the outsider, August Town was just another Jamaican garrison, zinc fences, rocky lanes, and the sound of gunfire interrupting prayer. But for those who knew it from within, it was a crucible, a place of life origins, burning with potential and heavy with prophecy. This was the world that raised Sizzla Kalonji. August Town was more than a backdrop. It was a living organism, a place where Rastafarian spirituality, ghetto wisdom, and cultural resistance coiled around the daily grind of survival. Sizzla's earliest memories were steeped in island culture, shaped by struggle and soul. His mother, a devout woman with a calm voice and a sharper intuition, kept the household grounded in prayer, discipline, and dignity. His father, a mechanical engineer and spiritual seeker, passed down not just knowledge, but conscious reasoning. There were no gilded microphones or air-conditioned studios in young Miguel's childhood, only the rhythm of the Caribbean in all its contradictions. Heat and holiness, violence and vibration, oppression and poetry. Miguel was quiet as a child, observant, thoughtful, but inside something smoldered. His schooling at Dunoon Technical High School exposed him to more than just textbooks. It revealed the battles for dominance in Jamaica's post-colonial landscape. The influences of foreign culture, the lure of fast money, the tug of war between Babylon and identity. Young minds were shaped by headlines, ganja smoke, and the gospel of resistance passed down from elder Rastas and street prophets. Music wasn't yet his weapon. Not formally, but it was everywhere. He soaked it in, Dennis Brown, Peter Tosh, Jacob Miller, and of course, the towering figure of Bob Marley. The global standard for what it meant to fight with melody, to speak with rhythm, to resist with music. These were not just artists, they were cultural custodians, guardians of a legacy that dared to speak truth to power. It wasn't long before Miguel began singing in local talent shows, sharpening his voice against the walls of hardship and hope. He wasn't trying to sound sweet, he was trying to sound real. Even then, there was an urgency to his tone, a fire waiting for permission to rise. But what truly changed the trajectory of his life wasn't just talent. It was Rastafari. The Bobo Ashanti order became his anchor. A path, a mirror, a revelation. Miguel Collins became Sizzla Kalonji. Sizzla for the fire, Kalonji for the warrior. He wasn't here to entertain. He was here to awaken. Rastafari offered a new language, a new identity. It gave structure to his rebellion and spirituality to his rage. He took the vow of the turbaned priesthood seriously, rejecting vanity, Babylon business, and the pollution of the mind. He didn't see music as a career. He saw it as a mission to uplift the downtrodden, to expose colonial lies, and to call black people back to themselves. By the mid-90s, Jamaica was in flux. Dancehall had taken over the soundscape. Conscious roots reggae was waning in the mainstream, replaced by rhythms that praised guns, girls, and glitter. But in this chaos, Sizzla emerged like a lion through the smoke, ready to bring back the power of music as revolutionary scripture. And he wasn't alone. Somewhere out there, a producer named Philip Faddies Burrell was also watching, listening for a voice that could shift the cultural tide. That moment, the meeting of Faddies and Sizzla, would be the start of something seismic. But the foundation had already been laid. The fire was born in August Town, and it was ready to burn down Babylon, one verse at a time. Long before Sizzla Kalonji stood on global stages, fists clenched and lyrics sharp as spears, he bowed his head in reverence to an ancient African order. one misunderstood by many, feared by others, but revered by those who truly listen. That order was Bobo Ashanti. In the 1990s, when Miguel Collins was still shaping his identity amid the heat of Kingston's spiritual and political battlegrounds, Rastafari was already split into branches, each with its own philosophy, discipline, and energy. But Bobo Ashanti stood apart. It wasn't just a movement. It was a lifestyle, a discipline, a declaration of cultural resistance etched into daily ritual. The Bobo Ashanti Order, founded by Prince Emmanuel Charles Edwards, called for a strict spiritual code. Turban and robe, celibacy until marriage, veganital diet, and daily prayers to the Most High. They rejected Western materialism and the false gods of capitalism. Their camp, Bobo Hill, sat high in the hills like a watchtower, a quiet force behind Jamaica's volcanic resistance energy. For Sizzla, this wasn't performance. It was purpose. He adopted the order fully, wrapped himself in white and red, began addressing Haile Selassie I as King Emmanuel I, Selassie I, Marcus I, the Holy Trinity. His music sharpened. His vision deepened. He wasn't just singing about the ghetto. He was channeling prophecy. From Bobo Hill to Judgment Yard, Sizzla became a vessel, one that carried island identity, black history, and Pan-African liberation in every syllable. He spoke of repenting Babylon, of returning to the roots, of embracing the black woman as queen, and of building community power through spiritual righteousness. In a time when dancehall leaned toward slackness, Sizzla turned his back to the glitter and faced the flame of truth. But this wasn't just a spiritual commitment, it was a political act. To be Bobo Ashanti in Jamaica was to stand against systemic injustice. To walk into banks and be refused entry for wearing your turban. To be labeled a madman or extremist by those too colonized to understand. To chant down Rome while raising children on ancestral law. Sizzla didn't flinch. He channeled it. Tracks like Praise Ye Jah, Babylon Eus Dembrain, and No White God were not just songs, they were doctrines. And they made him dangerous. To the status quo. To soft minds. To those who profited from keeping black people asleep. He dared to say what others only whispered. There's no white God watching over me. My God is black like the night sky. He wasn't asking permission. He was reclaiming language, rebuilding identity, reviving resistance. As Bobo Ashanti, Sizzla stood firm in the restoration of African pride, the destruction of colonial mentality, the resurrection of black kingship and queenhood. He called for the abolition of mental slavery, not just through marches or protests, but through sound, ritual, and lyrics laced in fire. His music became Rasta scripture, militant, melodic, and impossible to silence. By the late 90s, a new breed of youth began rising, dreadlocked, intense, fearless, inspired not by foreign rappers or MTV videos, but by the sight of a black man wrapped in a red turban, chanting fire into a cracked microphone. That man was Sizzla, and his voice didn't just echo through speakers. It resonated in hearts. It shook institutions. It reminded a generation that spirituality is rebellion, and that culture is a weapon. In the years that followed, the fire would only grow. Labels would come, critics would swarm, fans would scream, but Sizzla never bowed, because Bobo Ashanti warriors do not perform. They proclaim. Sometimes, the universe arranges collisions that change the course of culture. In 1995, one such collision happened in the hills of Kingston, between a rising flame named Sizzla Kalonji and a visionary soundman named Philip Fatties Burrell. Their union would not only alter the trajectory of Sizzla's life, but would redefine the course of reggae music for an entire generation. Fatties Burrell was no ordinary producer. He wasn't chasing hits, he was building legacy. As founder of Exterminator Records, he had already worked with giants like Luciano, Garnet Silk, and Sugar Minot. But he was seeking something more than sound. He was hunting for spirit. He found it in a young Rasta who walked like prophecy and sang like thunder. When Sizzla first walked into Fatty's studio, he wasn't the polished star we know now. He was raw, barefoot, eyes blazing, turban tight, voice loaded with divine rage and a calm that unnerved. There was no pretension, no posturing. Just intention. Fatty saw it immediately. Here was an artist who wasn't just hungry. He was driven by doctrine. They began recording almost immediately. The first sessions were electric. Sizzla would step into the booth, close his eyes, and deliver verses like downloads from Mount Zion. Fatty's knew how to engineer sound, how to strip the rhythm down to its roots and bones, so that Sizzla's message could pierce through Babylon's noise. What followed was not just a music career, it was a revolutionary collaboration. In 1995, Sizzla released Burning Up, a rugged debut that announced him as a new kind of voice, fiery, lyrical, unapologetically spiritual. But it was the albums that followed which would seal his place in cultural history. Crazy Jaw, 1997, was a masterwork. Minimalist production. Maximalist truth. On it, Sizzla declared war on Babylon systems, false gods, and internal weakness, all while lifting up the black family, Rastafari order, and African consciousness. His lyrics cut like scripture. Don't care where you're from, Rastamana come. Babylon system, time to tumble down. Then came Black Woman and Child, 1997. The classic that would elevate him into international consciousness. The album was a poetic love letter to black womanhood, family, and spiritual royalty. The title track was a bomb in an era of misogynistic slackness, a reminder that reggae still had a heart, and that revolution could sound like a lullaby sung by fire. Black Woman and Child, yeah yeah yeah, for you I really have so much love. It was Fatty's finest production. Clean, elegant, militant, and soft all at once. Together, he and Sizzla had created something rare. Cinematic music with revolutionary intent. Exterminator wasn't just a label, it became a spiritual lab. A place where music and identity merged. Where roots reggae was given new DNA. Where dancehall's aggression was redirected into righteous confrontation with corruption and inequality. They weren't just making records. They were forging weapons of sound. Sizzla would go on to release album after album, sometimes multiple in a year. His output was relentless. His style, unpredictable. His messages, rooted in cultural preservation, African history, and Caribbean resistance. Through it all, Exterminator sessions remained holy ground. A space where audio became ritual, where engineering became spiritual warfare. Fatty's had unlocked the fire. And Sizzla? Sizzla had become unstoppable. By the end of the decade, the world was paying attention. Jamaica knew it had something different on its hands. A new prophet, a lyrical warrior, and a sound that didn't bend for Babylon. Some albums are crafted for charts, others for culture. But a rare few divine few are carved into the soul of a people. In 1997, Sizzla Kalonji released Black Woman and Child, an album that did more than break ground. It reawakened a people's pride, restored a broken language, and reminded the world that reggae still carried prophecy. This was more than just a record. It was a spiritual offering, a cultural weapon, a love letter, and a war cry. At a time when reggae's consciousness was being drowned out by the booming rise of slackness and commercial dancehall, Black Woman and Child arrived like a pillar of fire in the middle of a storm. It wasn't about selling records. It was about saving identity. From the moment the first chords dropped, there was something different, something cinematic, deeply ancestral, almost ritualistic in tone. Fatty's Burrell's Exterminator production wrapped each song in clarity and restraint, giving Sizzla's voice the room to roar, whisper, and chant. The title track became the heartbeat of the project, and arguably, the heartbeat of a generation. Black Woman and Child. For you I really have so much love. Arms open wide, I need you to come inside. It was tenderness in a time of rage. A softness that didn't compromise strength. It flipped the narrative. While others were reducing women to verses of lust and conquest, Sizzla was elevating the womb, reminding listeners that the black woman is the origin of civilization, the divine vessel, the spiritual cornerstone of Africa and the Caribbean. But it wasn't just the title track. The entire album was a journey through time, an immersive narrative of struggle and resilience, from the hills of August Town to the mountains of Ethiopia. Songs like Guide Over Us, Hard Ground, and One Away captured the daily tension of youth in ghetto environments, caught between righteousness and retaliation, meditation and madness, resistance and survival. Sizzla's lyrical fire burned through it all. No time to waste, we haffy educate. Youth dem rise before it's too late. He wasn't preaching, he was pleading, but never from weakness. From authority, from the throne of Bobo Ashanti Fire, from the bloodline of black kings, from the drumbeat of ancestral memory. The impact of Black Woman and Child wasn't just sonic. It was spiritual. It was social. It was global. The album became a favorite not just in Jamaica, but across Africa, Europe, and urban America. It inspired classroom discussions, university lectures, Rastafari meditations, and underground movements. It bridged generations, reminding elders of the Marley era mission, while awakening younger listeners to a deeper cultural truth. It became a symbol of cultural resistance, reggae revival, and black love in its purest form. And in doing so, SZA didn't just rise as a star. He transformed into a symbol, a messenger, a sonic priest, and a cultural mirror in a world distorted by Babylon lies. Black Woman and Child wasn't SZA's commercial peak, but it was his spiritual apex. A moment where message, melody, and mission converged into a masterpiece that still plays loud in the streets, the hills, and the hearts of those who understand what the fire truly means. The fire didn't flicker after that. It spread, and the next chapter would ignite the entire reggae world. Every generation births a warrior, but not all warriors carry guns. Some carry words. Some load their lyrics with philosophy, aim their verses like truth-seeking missiles, and fire off rhythms that rattle the foundations of corrupted empires. SZA Kalonji is that kind of warrior. And for him, music has never been entertainment. It's always been warfare, a soundtrack for survival, and a sacred weapon in the eternal battle between the oppressed and the oppressors. From his earliest recordings, SZA didn't just rhyme. He redefined the battlefield. Where many used beats to boast, he used them to build movements, to resurrect forgotten values, and to challenge the mind as much as the body. Each line was a sword, each hook a rallying cry, each album a sermon. His targets were clear. Babylon systems that criminalize blackness, false education that distorts African identity, spiritual hypocrisy masked as modern religion, colonial residue embedded in language, policy, and posture, and most dangerously mental slavery passed from parent to child. SZA wasn't just rhyming about politics. He was confronting global systems of oppression with reggae's ancestral fire, sharpening it with the urgency of dancehall and the wisdom of Rastafari. Songs like Babylon Ayus Dem Brain, No White God, Solid as a Rock, Praise Ye Jah, Dem a Wonder, weren't hits in the traditional sense. They were manuals. They were mirrors. They were mind grenades thrown into the passive routines of everyday life. Dem a Wonder how we do this, how we rise and never fall. Forward ever, backward never. Jah Jah guide over all. That wasn't poetry. That was blueprint. In a world where lyrics were becoming increasingly hollow, SZA doubled down on depth. He fused Bible scripture, Afrocentric wisdom, and street intellect into a language uniquely his own. He could flip from blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, to Babylon Yesiah trap we in a mental cell. And he'd do it in the same verse, without pause, without apology. This wasn't just reggae. This was rebellion wrapped in rhythm. This was philosophy forged in fire. This was cultural preservation through sound. SZA understood something few artists ever grasp. Words shape nations. Words build gods. Words rewrite reality. And if he could control the narrative, he could influence the next generation's identity. He wasn't just addressing fans. He was addressing soldiers of spirit, carriers of truth, guardians of cultural memory. He urged young people to question what they were taught, to unlearn what Babylon normalized, to recognize their divinity, and to return to roots spiritual, historical, and musical. Even when controversy came, even when critics tried to censor his language or twist his meanings, SZA never diluted his fire. Because in his worldview, every lyric matters. Every beat is sacred, and every message is a mission. To this day, walk into any Jamaican community, or anywhere in the Caribbean diaspora, and you'll hear his voice echoing through shops, through taxis, through headphones. Not just because of how he sounds, but because of what he says. Because in a world of noise, SZA's message cuts through like prophecy. If you walk too close to fire, you'll get burned. And SZA Kalonji? He didn't just walk near the fire. He was the fire. Uncompromising. Unfiltered. Unapologetic. And when a voice dares to challenge Babylon's comfort, when it dares to speak truth unpolished, love unromanticized, and spirituality without institution, that voice becomes dangerous. To power. To industry. To those who feed off silence. From the earliest stages of his career, SZA's music wasn't just bold, it was blunt. He didn't speak in metaphors when he could use names. He didn't dilute his message to please the mainstream. This earned him both global reverence and international controversy. In Jamaica, he was hailed as a prophet. In certain parts of the West, he was flagged, censored, even banned. Some of the sharpest criticisms came from his lyrical stance on homosexuality, rooted in his interpretation of Rastafarian doctrine. corrupt political systems, often calling out Jamaican government officials by name, religious institutions, particularly Christianity, and its colonial baggage. Western media, which he accused of cultural theft and spiritual distortion. His 2002 track, Na Apologize, was a direct rebuke to critics who asked him to soften his language. In it, Sizzla made it clear, he'd rather face exile than edit his beliefs. I'm not apologizing to no baddie man. I'm burning fire straight. The line ignited outrage from LGBTQ+ communities and human rights groups across Europe and North America. Concerts were protested. Tours were canceled. Radio bans were issued. But Sizzla didn't flinch. To him, controversy wasn't scandal. It was confirmation. If I don't offend Babylon, then I'm not doing my job, he once said in an interview. This wasn't just rebellion. It was doctrinal duty. As a Bobo Ashanti priest, he believed that compromise is corruption, and that truth must be spoken, even if it costs you everything. Still, the criticism hurt. He wasn't immune to the consequences. There were moments when Jamaica's own media distanced itself. Moments when international platforms refused to play his music. Not because it lacked quality, but because it carried too much spiritual conviction for commercial culture to digest. But even in isolation, he thrived. His fan base, rooted deeply in the Caribbean, Africa, and conscious Black communities worldwide, never left his side. They understood the complexity of the man behind the message. They recognized the difference between literal violence and cultural defiance. To them, Sizzla wasn't preaching hate. He was defending heritage. He was calling out systems of erasure, not individuals. He was reminding the world that reggae was never meant to be safe. It was born in resistance, forged in struggle, raised to rebel. And yet, beneath the fire, there was always a deeper core, love for his people, devotion to Rastafari, protection of spiritual values. Even his harshest verses were rooted in a fear that Black youth were being fed lies about who they were, what they were worth, and what progress looked like. Sizzla saw himself as a shield. Controversial? Yes. But to him, silence was a greater sin. In the end, the cost of speaking truth is steep. He paid it with canceled visas, media blackouts, and one-sided headlines. But Sizzla never paid with his soul. He kept that intact, wrapped in his turban, etched in his psalms, preserved in his poetry. Because for a man like Sizzla, controversy isn't the enemy. It's the evidence that the message is working. In the early 2000s, reggae was shifting. The mainstream industry wanted cleaner rhythms, smoother edges, something palatable enough for playlists in New York, London, and Tokyo. But then came an album from a fire-wrapped prophet that didn't just sneak through the gate. It kicked it open. That album was the real thing. And it marked Sizzla Kalonji's crossover moment, not by compromise, but by sheer force of spirit. Released in 2002, The Real Thing was Sizzla's most commercially successful project to date. But it wasn't watered down. It wasn't a shift toward pop. Instead, it was a reconfiguration of the flame, sharp, melodic, and unapologetically Caribbean. Sizzla found the perfect balance between dancehall swagger and reggae soul, between consciousness and romantic fire, between the street energy of Kingston and the global longing for truth in rhythm. The tracklist read like a manifesto of spiritual survival and sensual mastery. Solid as a rock. Thank You Mama. Trot MT Zion. Simplicity. Rejoice. And of course, Just One of Those Days, Dry Cry. Dry cry, even tears. Even my heart cry, but who cares? That line hit a global nerve. In clubs. In headphones. In cars flying down the highway at midnight with broken-hearted youth behind the wheel. It was reggae's emotional resurgence, the kind of vulnerable cry that brought men and women together through shared ache and resilience. Sizzla had done the unthinkable. He went platinum in spirit and gold in numbers, without changing who he was. There was no tuxedo, no label-driven image revamp. Just the same turban, the same fire, and a microphone wired to the truth. The Real Thing wasn't just a hit album. It was a moment in Caribbean music history, a declaration that Jamaican music didn't need to imitate foreign formulas to win international hearts. It reminded listeners everywhere that island culture was already rich, already melodic, already profound. This was authentic storytelling in music, delivered by one of the region's most polarizing and prophetic voices. And the world responded. Europe, Africa, Japan, the Caribbean diaspora. Urban undergrounds and roots festivals alike welcomed Sizzla like a spiritual ambassador. not just of Rastafari, but of a resistance that was danceable, dangerous, and deeply rooted in ancestral power. Suddenly, artists like Damian Marley, Capleton, and Anthony B found new global lanes opening. The fire Sizzla had fanned, sometimes alone, sometimes under criticism, had turned into a global blaze. But with international fame came new pressures. Expectations to soften. Requests for endorsements. Increased scrutiny from media and governments. Sizzla remained grounded. He still performed in his robe. Still lived in Judgment Yard, surrounded by community. Still refused to shake hands with Babylon for a seat at their table. Instead, he built his own table. While others looked outward, Sizzla looked inward, focusing not on red carpets but on building a legacy through sound and structure. And yet, wherever he traveled, one thing remained constant. The roar of fans singing along to Solid as a Rock, fists in the air, voices cracking with passion. Because they weren't just singing a hook, they were affirming a life code. They can't keep a good man down. Always keep a smile when they want me to frown. Keep the vibes and they stood my grounds. That wasn't performance. That was protection, a mantra Sizzla wrote for himself, and in doing so, handed over to the world. The real thing was a cultural reset. Proof that reggae and dancehall could exist in the same body. That spirituality and sensuality could harmonize. And that truth still sells when it moves with rhythm and burns with purpose. There are stages. There are studios. And then there is Judgment Yard. More than just a place, more than a compound or headquarters. Judgment Yard is a living, breathing manifestation of Sizzla Kalonji's philosophy. A spiritual fortress. A cultural ecosystem. A beacon for youth, truth, and Rastafari resilience in the heart of August Town. After the real thing catapulted Sizzla into international stardom, the industry expected him to move uptown, to upgrade, elevate, detach from the streets that made him. But Sizzla did the opposite. He planted deeper, right into the unforgiving land of his origins, where gunfire was still more common than gospel, where politicians only showed up near elections, and where Rastafari was both sanctuary and shield. Sizzla took his earnings, his energy, and his ever-growing influence, and poured it into Judgment Yard. What began as a small house became a community hub. Studios for recording, gardens for Ital living, spaces for reasoning, shelter for youth with nowhere else to turn, chant circles for Bobo Ashanti rituals, open gates for elders, babies, revolutionaries, and wanderers alike. Judgment Yard was not a mansion. It was a mission. Every wall told a story of struggle, of divinity, of redemption. You could hear drums at dawn, scripture at noon, fire crackling near the Nyabingi Circle at sunset. Some came for the vibes. Others came to change their lives. It became a cultural pilgrimage site. Journalists, scholars, Rastas from across the globe, musicians, curious wanderers, those seeking spiritual grounding, those needing to witness what it looked like when a man turned fame into foundation. Sizzla didn't just preach about community. He built one, and he didn't build it in isolation. He lived within it. No private security, no gated driveway, just the people, the purpose, and the pulse of the hills. Judgment Yard became a living metaphor for what Sizzla had always said in his music, that self-reliance is power, that African spirituality must be practiced, not just posted, that youth needs structure rooted in heritage, not hype, that island identity is sacred and must be protected with both ritual and revolution. And it wasn't perfect. Judgment Yard, like Sizzla, attracted controversy. Accusations. Misunderstandings. Some critics said it was too closed off, too religious, too militant. Others said it was the only place they ever felt truly free. But whether praised or critiqued, its mission remained unchanged. To be a fireplace in a cold world. To be a spiritual classroom outside of Babylon schooling. To be a center for cultural preservation in a time of algorithmic amnesia. There are few artists in Caribbean music history who transformed their physical environment the way Sizzla did. He didn't just sing about change. He constructed it, brick by brick, chant by chant, album by album. Even now, you can still walk through Judgment Yard. You'll see children barefoot on the red dirt, young men tuning up equipment in the open-air studio. Sizzla himself, turban tight, head high, planting vegetables, pouring tea, offering a nod to strangers. It's not a museum. It's a mission still in motion. Because in a world where artists chase mansions, Sizzla built a movement. And in a culture obsessed with visibility, he built a yard designed for vision. Judgment Yard, is not just a place on the map. It's a place in the story of Caribbean identity, and its heartbeat still pulses to the rhythm of reggae, Rastafari, and a man whose fire never flickers. Some artists fade with the decade. Others burn through generations, leaving behind not ashes, but blueprints. Sizzla Kalonji is no longer just a name on a flyer. He's a pillar in the temple of Caribbean cultural resistance, a keeper of fire, a custodian of truth in a world constantly being rewritten by mainstream narratives. And the fire? It still burns. By the late 2010s, as global music moved toward algorithmic trends and hyper-polished hits, many wondered if voices like Sizzla's would survive. But what they forgot is this. Fire doesn't need algorithms. It needs oxygen. And Sizzla never ran out of air. From Judgment Yard to stages in Nairobi, Paris, Port of Spain, and Tokyo, Sizzla's message transcended genre, language, and generation. He became not just a reggae star, but a global teacher, a spiritual symbol, and a living archive of Caribbean identity. His lyrics, his rituals, his steadfast commitment to the principles of Rastafari, and his refusal to be shaped by Babylon made him more than an artist. He became a cultural landmark. At the heart of Sizzla's continued relevance lies one word: preservation. In a time when much of the world's cultural memory is being wiped, watered down, or commodified, Sizzla stands as one of the last men singing from the old scrolls, while still crafting new chapters. He blends tradition and modernity with fearless conviction. Albums like Victory, 2011, I'm Yours, 2017, On a High, 2021, Everlasting, 2016, prove that he never paused, he evolved. But he never chased relevance. Instead, he expanded his roots. And in doing so, he inspired a new wave of conscious youth across the diaspora. Young artists in Jamaica, Trinidad, Ghana, Nigeria, and the UK began citing Sizzla not just as a musical influence, but as a philosophical foundation. His teachings, chanted through rhythm and ritual, reached Afrobeats, hip-hop, spoken word, and even activist classrooms. He became a bridge, connecting the Pan-African sound system from Kingston to Accra to Atlanta to Addis Ababa. But legacy isn't just about longevity. It's about transformation. And Sizzla transformed how we view Black love, how we understand cultural resistance, how we protect spirituality in a capitalist world, how we speak truth, even when it's uncomfortable, how we build in the same communities we rise from. His name sits alongside the greats: Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Burning Spear, Dennis Brown, Garnet Silk, Capleton, not because of fame, but because of fire with purpose. Because Sizzla didn't just record albums, he recorded a way of life, a manual of cultural preservation for future generations to study, chant, and live by. And even today, if you pass by Judgment Yard, you'll still hear him, chanting, advising, recording, mentoring, still grounded, still lion-hearted, still building, still burning. In the era of curated images and studio filters, Sizzla remains raw, rooted, and resilient, a voice the system couldn't silence and the industry couldn't contain. Because true fire, it doesn't expire. It evolves. The sound has changed. The tempo is quicker. The rhythms are brighter. The bassline leans more digital, more global, more Afrobeats than rocksteady. But listen closely, beneath the auto-tuned melodies and viral hooks, and you'll still hear it. Fire. Sizzla's fire. In an era where Afrobeats dominates streaming platforms and global reggae branches into experimental hybrids, it would be easy to assume that the militant chants of a barefoot youth from August Town had faded into memory. But in truth, the opposite is happening. Sizzla Kalonji's influence is woven into the very DNA of modern Afro-Caribbean music. When Nigerian stars like Burna Boy, Wizkid, and Tem speak about their roots, they often mention reggae, not just as a sound, but as a philosophy. When Jamaican artists like Protoge, Chronix, Kabaka Pyramid, and Lila Ike push forward a roots revival, they're standing on ground Sizzla already scorched. This is what true legacy looks like. It multiplies. It mutates without losing its origin. It echoes across continents and back into the souls of the young. Sizzla's unapologetic blend of militant truth-telling, Afrocentric spirituality, sexual restraint and moral rigor, and a fierce commitment to cultural identity set the blueprint for a generation now redefining what it means to be Caribbean, African, and independent in the music industry. And while newer artists may trade turbans for designer shades and chant less and stream more, the message, the cultural storytelling remains grounded in the consciousness Sizzla helped revive. This isn't nostalgia. This is inheritance. The global shift toward Black consciousness, Pan-African unity, and Afro-diasporic collaboration owes much to cultural architects like Sizzla, artists who made it possible to stand tall while being rooted in something older than trend. In interviews, young musicians quote his lyrics like scripture. In Africa, his music plays not just at parties, but at protests, weddings, ceremonies, classrooms, and ritual spaces. In Jamaica, even those who once criticized his fire now understand its function. Because fire doesn't always comfort. Sometimes it purifies. As we look at this moment in Caribbean music evolution, we see genres collapsing into each other. Dancehall fusing with drill, reggae mingling with trap, Afrobeats wrapped in gospel textures. Yet, beneath it all, the cultural spine holds firm. A spine carved, in part, by Sizzla's discography. And he's not finished. Still releasing. Still reasoning. Still chanting. Still performing in the hills of Jamaica and the stadiums of Africa. Still standing in the same spiritual light that birthed his earliest recordings. Because for Sizzla, the mission was never about popularity. It was always about preservation. Preserving memory. Preserving message. Preserving music as a weapon for cultural clarity. So yes, the rhythms may evolve. The audiences may shift. The platforms may change. But one thing is certain. The fire never dies.